Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive. And we are waiting for our guest, the honorable and noble dear brother, Majid, Abdul Majid, from Charlotte, North Carolina. And soon as our dear brother and dear friend is with us, we will bring him right on. We're ready. We're anxious to hear from him. I'm sure he's anxious to be with us. And we are going to reach him. We ask Almighty God's blessings upon our noble and honorable audience. We thank you for your participation. And as soon as we can have our brother with us, we will have him. He's been a city councilman, an airline pilot. He has been a businessman, a great brother in his own right, and also a radio host. So, and an airline pilot, and we're just honored to have him with us. So we're going to wait for him to come forth. We're trying to reach him now. Brother I'm going to redial him. So, dear beloved people, right now while we wait our brother, we're going to reach out. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive, and I just want to thank you for your patience with us. And if you would excuse me just 1 minute, and I'm very happy. We are all now getting ready for the Ramadan session, which will be held in Chicago tomorrow. We're presenting, supposedly on tomorrow, but we have been delayed. And God willing, we will be going to Chicago at the national headquarters of the ministry, the worldwide ministry of Imam Waqfuddin Muhammad. We thank you, and we appreciate your patience with us. Dear beloved people, Ramadan Mubarak, greetings to our noble and honorable listening audience. I must tell you, this is sometimes difficult doing this program 7 days a week, but the spirit is willing, sometimes the body is acts up, but we keep on ticking. Take our liquors and we keep on click. So we thank you and appreciate you. Just bear with us a moment. Oh, peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. I thought we were on the air. What Religion Means Alive, but I think we just have come on the air. I'm going to ask my dear friend, Brother Muhammad Sharif, convener Muhammad Sharif and soldier Muhammad Sharif, if I were permitted to call him a captain, I would. He's such a leader, such an organizer. I was wondering if he could help out and co-host the broadcast.
Well, dear beloved people,
Good beans come in multi-packages. And when I was growing up, I was a Christian, and I used to wait for the Christmas tree to be lit. I wait for Santa Claus to come down the chimney, and my parents would usually give me one toy. Sometimes I believe they get it out of a bubble gum machine, but they were very sincere people, good Christian Baptist people. Prior to my meeting the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but I never knew that there would day come where I would have be on radio out of New York with Religion Means Alive, and I would have a multi-dimensional person. I met teachers and preachers, and the person of the great Samuel DeWitt Proctor, Monica Johnson, Virgil Alexander Woods, and many other great preachers. I'm proud of the fact that I come from a long line of those persons. But I didn't know when I came in the Nation of Islam and the community of Imam David Muhammad that I would meet a person that had been an airline pilot, had been a businessman, Burger King. I think he's a part of a conspiracy to get me hungry. Also a land developer, a politician, went in office. Candidate, big smile on his face, commercial pilot, and he's such a modest, decent human being. I speak of none other than our brother and your brother, Brother Majid, who is also, I'm sure, one of the finest politicians that the state of North Carolina has ever produced. And don't be surprised if you see him in some nation heading campaign. I introduce to you in Psalm, and also a great preacher and teacher, Brother Majid, welcome to Religion Means Alive.
Well, assalamu alaikum, Imam Afrat. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir, we hear you well, loud and clear.
Okay. It's a great honor to be on your program, and you know, I've listened to you. You know, I got you on my iPhone, and you know, when it comes up time for the Afro Muhammad Show, I try to tune in and listen to what's going on in the community. And you know, I've always admired your zeal and your commitment to community and helping us to you know, push the program and ideas and the healthy community environment and under the leadership of Imam W.D. Muhammad. We appreciate you for that, brother. God bless you for that.
God bless you and appreciate you. How did you become Brother Majid? Were you born and raised in Islam? Were you from the holy city Mecca? Or how many miles outside of the holy city Mecca were you born? Give us your origin so we'll know how we speak to such legendary figures as you.
Oh, Lord. I'm a country boy. I'm a Raleigh.
That's being sophisticated to me.
I'm a country boy. Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked that. I grew up in a neighborhood, and I don't know, somehow this it slipped in my subconscious. But I never had the idea of, you know, being a pilot or flying or anything like that. But I had a, a neighbor, and her husband was a gunner I guess it might have been a B-25 or something, World War II or something like that. And he got shot down. And I would always go up to her house and look at her. He had his gunnery, you know, had pictures and all his library of information that he had to use for, you know, mastering that his career in the military. And I used to go to their library, her little library, and look at the books. And also, I had a uncle who was matter of fact, he's still living. He's 96 years old. He's a full colonel he was a full colonel. His name is Jackson. I call him Uncle Jack. He's up in Harrisburg now, but he's 96 years old. And I would always go in the summertime and visit them all over the United States at different in different posts. He was in the Army. And so I don't know. I guess, and look, here's another strange thing. When we, my father used to take us to the airport. Now, this was in Raleigh, North Carolina, back in the 50s. And we couldn't even go into the area for the airplanes. It was segregated. We couldn't, you know, you couldn't even get on the airplane. We used to stand across the field, way across the field, watch the airplanes. And so I don't know, you know, as I went to A&T State University in Greensboro, North Carolina, they had an excellent program in military science. They had Army ROTC, they had Air Force ROTC, and it was mandatory. That's back when A&T was like 6 men to 1 woman. And Bennett College was across the tracks and so like that, but it was mainly engineering and agricultural school and business too, but heavily engineering. And I went to be an architecture engineer. My grandfather was an architecture engineer, graduated from Shaw University back in the turn of the century.
Wow.
Yes, and he was a big builder. He built lots of buildings. Matter of fact, some of them are still there now that he built. The owner of the bank building for Mechanic and Farmers Bank is still there. The others were torn down. But he developed the African-American section in Raleigh, and he was an architect and a developer. And so what I was saying is, I don't want to lose my train of thought, is that traveling, I guess, A&T had the Air Force ROTC, and it was mandatory. The first 2 years you had to be in it. It was mandatory. And so somehow I took the test, and I passed the pilot portion. And that's how I got an advanced ROTC for 2 years. And then I went on the pilot's training. And pilot's training was quite an experience because I had come from all African-American schools, which were good schools. We had good schools in Raleigh. You know, people talk about segregated schools. And when I came in Raleigh, North Carolina, oh, man, we had people on the board. We had great schools. They were just segregated. I don't remember no secondhand books or nothing like that, but some of those people's experience in segregation and things like that out in county and other areas and other parts of the other states and stuff. You say segregated schools, man, they will fight you. But I enjoyed all my elementary school teachers had master's degrees. Isn't that something?
Oh, yeah, you know, I came from the same tradition. Yeah,
and
those were good days.
And I was born in my uncle, on my father's side. He was also he graduated from Shaw Leonard Medical School, also at the turn of the century. See, the Jews taught at that school. That's at that time in the 1800s, 1900s. The Jews taught. He graduated from Leonard Medical School. I had two uncles graduate on my father's side and my mother's side. Graduated from that school, from School of Medicine, and he had his own hospital, Macaulay Hospital, right downtown. And my father was born in a hospital, and my mother was born before they were born in that hospital, and I was born in that hospital. I had my tonsils removed in that hospital. That was a private hospital. So we had the banking system, and my uncle was a major founder of the Mechanic and Farmers Bank, which still exists today in 3 or 4 cities around North Carolina, and so we had an enclosed community, all the businesses and everything, and so I never went to a Caucasian doctor. That was something strange for me. Dentists, everything. I always went in our own community. We had all the elements of our own community. So you know, I had a good upbringing, and I just got into that situation. And when I went to pilot's training, I was like 1 in 800 at a base. I was like 1 in 800, and I was only African American a lot of times. Maybe we had 2 once that came through, but there were like 8 pilot's training bases. And so, as a matter of fact, that's where I first met Chappie James. Speaking of Chappie,
wow.
James, you remember Chappie James?
Uh-huh. Sure, I remember General Chappie James. Yes.
I knew Chappie. He was a marvel. Chappie was an outstanding man. He was outstanding. He was a big figure. He was a character, man. Chappie James was a character. And so I remember one time I was just about finished. I was in my supersonic flight training. I was in the supersonic flight training mode. That was the last mode before you got out. And somebody said, I was going to the Oak Club. And I said, come on, meet Chappie. I met Chappie, man. Chappie pulled me over to the side. And we just talked. He just put the whole club. It was all around him like a rock star. He said, come on. He said, hold it. I got to talk to this. I talked to my brother here. So we got off to the side and we talked. And Chappie said, we started talking in the conversation. He said, well, look, I'm getting ready to get out. Because Chappie was a full colonel at the time. And he should have been a general. So he said he was getting ready to get out. And I said, you know, Chappie, I'm going to leave this thing too. That's what I said. I said, Chappie, I'm leaving this thing too because I'm tired of these people. You know, they own my case. And, you know, I had a lot of resistance, you know. I didn't even have a roommate in Palace Training. I didn't have a roommate. And in the beginning, so I didn't have the benefit of the social situation, studying for tests, and all that kind of stuff. But Chappie told me to hang in there. He said, if I quit, he said, they would like nothing better for you to quit. They have won.
Wow.
Don't let them win. Finish it on out. And so Chappie said, but he was getting out. Just, you know, Johnson took Chappie went from like colonel to like four-star general about 3 years, man. Because Tracy was like,
wow.
Because I guess he threatened the guy. But I know Chappie, and I think Chappie, and this is somehow Alice Lama's helped me to deal with situations because Chappie was living in two worlds. He was Chappie James, attorney general and everything. And then he was the real Chappie James, like going from hot to cold. You know, when you go from take ice out of the freezer and go from hot to cold, it'll crack
yes.
on you. 52
yeah.
years. Chappie died at 52 years old. That's too young. I think it was the
That's
pressure
too
of
young.
Living in different worlds and not knowing how to make those adjustments in the two worlds that killed Chappie. That's unfortunate.
Yeah,
but you just asked me.
Yeah.
You know, you started out asking me about some things, but and I also on my father's side, my grandfather was a great builder. He also on the other side, he did a lot of construction, but his father was the greatest stonemason in North Carolina. He built
wow.
the chapel of St. Augustine College. It's on a historic site now, that chapel.
Yes, I know that the historical Episcopal College.
Yeah, my father's side built that.
Wow.
He built that. He was a great stonemason, man. And so, you know, I have, fortunately, I have a lot, and my uncle was the mayor of Rock. That was when I was named after before I came into the, you know, Nation of Islam and changed my name, you know. He was the mayor in 1973. He was the mayor of Raleigh, and I think he and Sharp James at that time were about that was the Black Caucus in the United States at that time.
Wow.
So I come from I got a lot of pressure on me to try to do something and try, you know, I can't keep up with those people, but I tell you one thing that they have had an impression on me, and I have one aunt. This bitch, her name is Anna Julia Cooper. You ever heard of Anna Julia Cooper?
Sure.
She's a
you know what? Remember, I read the Baltimore Afro, the Afro-American, the Norfolk German Guide, and those papers kept us all connected to the African-American community, the black community throughout the South. So I remember people like Samuel D. Witt Proctor. I remember...
He was the president of A&T when I was there my freshman year.
I know Dr. Proctor very well. See,
mm-hmm.
I want to ask
so
you, how is it that a nice brother like you ended up in the Nation of Islam and ultimately in Al-Islam? Because a man like you with a voice like you and a charm like you, you should have been the pastor, the senior pastor of the White Rock Baptist Church, the president of the historical black big world colleges. That's the track that you were trained on.
I came into contact with when I was in Dayton, Ohio. I was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I flew out in the States. I flew out of there. I flew the later model B-52s. Overseas, we flew the older model B-52s. But that's where I came in contact with the Nation of Islam. I used to buy the paper. I would buy the paper and look the paper. I had my fro, and you know, a lot of times was going on, the Black Panthers were going on. But out of all of them, I thought that the group of in the Nation of Islam, following Allah Muhammad, I thought that they were for real. And I wouldn't, you know, I kind of got some information about the Nation of Islam, but I was on the periphery. You know, I come from a family who has always been community oriented and doing things in the community and leaders in the community. So, you know, I get that in my DNA. But this Nation of Islam, and I like what they were doing. And I remember that I used to see that in the paper. We need to fly our own. You remember when they had the pilots in the cockpit and stuff like
that? Yes, sir.
I got that somewhere. I got to find. I hope I can find that. But that was a very that picture meant a thousand words to me. We got to fly. We got to build this nation. We got to fly our own jets and all that. And, you know. So I guess I was getting subliminally seduced because mm-hmm. I and being a community and how I'm not looked at community, but on a national scale, I was always like the things that, and I liked the sincerity of the brothers and what they did, and so it came a point in my time in my life that I was just I wanted to dedicate my life to the improvement of the community, and Ahmad Muhammad was the one doing it. And, yeah. And I made that decision. It helped me. Focus on something as a goal, and to be a part of something that was progressive, and to help solve our problems in the African American community. Now, I also was introduced to it more for formally. Through a strange medium, I was in a bar, and the guy gave me a message to the black man.
Wow!
Isn't that something? I was in a bar, and later from the conversation, he gave me a message to the black man. And
wow.
And when I read that, oh, my goodness, I was fired up. When I read that, oh, my goodness, I was just, that was it. I had to go. And I pulled up in my Porsche to the Temple of Islam. And they didn't know who I was. They didn't know I was an FBI agent or whatever. But who is this?
What city was this in? And Cincinnati?
This was
what
in Raleigh,
city
North Carolina.
You remember the great pioneer,
that mercy on soul and grant him paradise? That's who I came in under. And he
you came in, and you came in as a great man.
Allahu Akbar.
Now, how did you? You were also a pilot for the Nation of Islam. Is that correct?
Yeah, I left the airline. I wrote Ahmad Elijah Muhammad and Rasul, the secretary at that time. He wrote me back, and I was the instructor. I left the airlines. In the meantime, that was the idea. But I was the dean of the brothers in the University of Islam in Raleigh, North Carolina, in Raleigh, Durham, under Kenneth Muhammad, and then from there I went to Chicago, and I was they took me in to take over the aviation department and to the Nation of Islam at that time. That was I came in 73 and 1976, the early 1976. I was they brought me to Chicago and to take over the aviation department. Hello?
How many planes did we have at that time? How many planes did the nation?
Well, we used to have a Constellation, but that was crashed.
I know about that.
Yeah, we had them for cargo, and we had some light cargo planes. We had some light planes. We had a hangar. We had a hangar facility. We hangar a lot of the dignitaries. Planes over in, you remember Dr. Williams Clinic in Chicago?
Yes, you're talking about Dr. Williams and his
brother. That's right.
Dr. Williams. Jasper Williams. Yes, and the Williams brothers.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
All of them had airplanes.
Yes, sir.
All of them had airplanes. We hangered at airplanes over, and you know, and we also had the jet, you know, the I forget what kind of jet that was, but that was hanging over at
Let me give a space break to tell the people. We're speaking with Brother Majid, Abdul Majid, and we're discussing his career, but we're also discussing the Nation of Islam, and this brother here has the privilege and honor of heading up the Nation of Islam Aviation Department. This is before Reverend Dr. Creflo Dollar head of the aviation department, former Reverend Tommy Jakes, head of aviation department. The Nation of Islam is the pioneer of African-American organization. I know there were African-Americans like Dr. Jasper Williams, and I remember his brother. There were three brothers. They were all physicians. They were Honorable Dr. Muhammad's physicians. Had a huge clinic. We had, I believe, in fact, Valerie Jarrett, the person who's the counselor to the president, her, I believe this is her first cousin, not her uncle, Eugene Dibble. Well, he also worked for us. Yes,
yeah.
Would you continue?
Yeah, I remember Dibble. I didn't meet him formally, but I remember Dibble, you know. Mm-hmm.
Did you have occasion to meet the Honorable Elijah Muhammad?
I never met Dibble. I think he went out before I got there, you know. I think Dibble
did you
had
meet
to meet the bank.
He did. He was responsible for negotiating the Guaranty National Bank. Yeah. Did you have an occasion to meet the Honorable Elijah Muhammad?
Well, when we were corresponding through, you know, the mail and stuff, he died. You know, in 75.
Yes,
and then I got there in 76. I got there the first part of right after in 76. I got there to take over the department. But that was the, that was the initial communications and Rasul was following his instructions to get me there.
And you did meet the Honorable Imam Debedin Muhammad.
Oh, yes, sir. That was my good friend. And we've had, you know, I've been blessed to on many occasions, very close relationships with Imam W.D. Muhammad, and he's my good friend.
You went back to North Carolina, and you became a real estate developer. You owned a Burger King, and you also ran for political office. So, bring us up to date with what happened after you left Chicago and returned to the great state of North Carolina.
Well, you know, the one thing about the Nation of Islam at that time, everybody, all these ambassadors from all over the world, I had a chance to meet. I met people from Switzerland, Muslims from Switzerland, Muslims from Guyana, from all over. It was a hot activity. You know, we were dealing with people fish from Peru and. We were dealing with the pouch foods and all those kind of things. It was just a lot going on there, you know. And everybody had come into Chicago, as this really a pool of resources of the supposed to be, you know, the sharpest in our community to administer the businesses and to administer the aspects of community building, and really came all over from all over the United States for at least a 2-year period. We were there in Chicago, and all around that masjid was activity. Muslims living all around the masjid and walking for back. It was something to see. But after Imam cut down on the business because we understand what was going on. He had to kill the cancer, and so everybody went back out. I think that's a lost plan. Everybody went back out. So I went back to – I had befriended the ambassador to the UN, and I met him in Chicago. He had dinner at my house. You know, a lot of people had dinner with my house from different countries, and they were leaders in their country. But this house guy happened to be the ambassador to Guyana to the United States. And as we talked, and another friend of mine from Guyana, he introduced me to him, and he wanted me to come to Guyana to take over their whole air force. Mm-hmm. Hey, that's what he wanted me to do. He wanted me to take over train their pilots, take over the whole air force, and take it away from the British. That was his plan. And so I visited Guyana on two occasions. But between the first and the second visit to Guyana, they assassinated him on the plane, and unfortunately, because that's just what happened. You know, that's high, I guess, international intrigue. But anyway, I met a guy down there, a brother who was he was my entree, and that's what he wanted. But that's what I was supposed to do. But in the meantime, I met a brother named Hamilton Bilal. Hamilton Bilal, Muslim brother, He was the head of the Department of Agriculture. And so after talking with him and I was, you know, I talked with the president also, but my great, I guess, mentor and person who wanted me to be in that position since he had passed on, that kind of went away, you know. So Hamilton said, you know, look, I said, since he was the head of the Department of Agriculture, or Minister of Agriculture, I said, Hamilton, what about if I go back and get a master's degree in, like, say, animal agriculture education? I specialize in animal science. And I go back, I get that 2 years, and I come back and I work with you, and we'll do some, because agriculture is the language of the world. 80% of the people produce for 100%. Not here in America, of course, they're 5% because of modern agriculture techniques and all that kind of stuff, and I guess they got all kind of genetic stuff they're doing. But generally speaking, that's how it is. So I saw agriculture as being the language of the world. So I was going to go back to school to get that language. And that's what I did. I got a master's degree in agriculture. My undergrad is business administration, but I needed that master's degree in agriculture, and I needed the I wanted to specialize in animal science. So I was going to go back to work with the Minister of Agriculture there. And so that's what I did. And just before I finished up and I'm getting to go back, this guy asked me, did I want to go into Burger King business? And I said, man, I planned this thing. I worked on this thing for the last 2 years or so, and that was my goal. But he convinced me to go in with him in the Burger King business. So, and it's either Charlotte or Tuskegee. So I said, okay, I'm Charlotte, not Tuskegee. So I went in business with him, and eventually after a year, I bought him out. And so I became the sole owner of the Burger King in Charlotte. And by that time, I got a letter from Hamilton Bilal, and guess what, Brother Emmanuel? Hello? Are you there?
Yes, sir. I had you on. I had it on mute, so in case there was background.
Okay.
You were continuing to Hamilton Bilal.
Yeah, Hamilton is now the president of Guyana. Isn't that amazing? He's the president now, Guyana. And all this happened through me meeting people, ambassadors and people like this from all over the world, because they wanted to come and see Ambulaj Muhammad. They wanted to come, and they liked what we were doing and everything. But at that time,
I want you to repeat this again, because somebody just walked into the studio, and they should have heard it. You had met Hamilton. Give us again the name of the brother.
Hamilton. That's his Muslim.
Hamilton Bilal. Hamilton Bilal, who was studying, who convinced you to go into the Burger King business, you met while you were working on
the business. Hamilton Bilal convinced me. Hamilton Bilal convinced me he had the Department of Agriculture there. He headed up, they call it the Ministry of Agriculture. So that's why I went to get a master's degree in agriculture to come back and then come back to Guyana and work with him in the Ministry of Agriculture since the aviation thing. The door had closed because they had assassinated the ambassador, but Hamilton eventually became president. At that time, I had established. I was about four years into my Burger King business, and so I couldn't just uproot me because my root was too deep in Charlotte. So I didn't go back to Guyana. But that was just interesting. You said, well, what happened after I left Chicago? And I left Chicago with the goal and objective to improve myself in the field of agriculture and learn that language and go to Guyana, evidently I'm supposed to be here. So that's how I got to Charlotte. And then subsequently I Mojave Gantt, who ran for Senate against Jesse Helms.
Yes, sir.
He asked me to be on a committee. Some city committee. I think it was Clean Cities Committee at the time. And for one thing, you know, I got involved with that. He asked me because I was involved with community with my Burger King, and so I got involved. Started getting involved in that. And you know, as I said again, I got a political DNA, but I was in the business mode at that particular time, and I hadn't planned on anything. But I subsequently, people asked me to run for office. I served on the Housing Authority. I served on the Planning Commission. I served for the North Carolina North Carolina Commission on Education for Economic Growth, with dealing with the planning for education on the governor's panel when I was in Charlotte. And so, you know, I just got involved in the community. And then I'm a city councilman. I got elected city councilman, and for 8 years I was city councilman in Charlotte. And I was also chaplain with the North Carolina Department of Corrections for 14 years. And I got involved in real estate, you know, And, you know, I love that bar. I love that bar.
You know what, brother? I want to ask you.
Hello?
I want to ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
The question I want to ask you. You talked about your grandfather being an architect. You talked about relatives of yours being physicians, a bank. Mm-hmm. You think in a lot of ways we were much better off when we had separate communities, even though, I mean, you know, North Carolina has been always a state where African-American businesses flourish.
And education also.
I didn't even get education. I didn't want to talk about business before we get to education. But, most people don't know that Shaw University had its own medical school at the turn of the century.
And engineering school also.
This was supported by us. So, I mean, what I'm saying to our people is that we were making a lot of progress. There were African-American hospitals in North Carolina, in Virginia. I want to ask you the pluses and the minuses of what we call the segregated era. Would you share your frank and honest opinion on that?
Well, it's like this. Remember, you saw the movie by Jackie Robinson, but the gates for the African American professionals were higher than the gates for the other leagues that they couldn't play in.
That's right.
So they saw that as a big old piece of pie to bite into. So they weren't doing no favors in one way, but like I said, and all that stayed within, you know, the promoters and all that kind of stuff. That money stayed in the community. So I would say it like that. You know, when segregation came, hey, they took the best players, switched them over to the league. They kept the gates, and our industry declined. Just like the colleges at A&T, we had the best. You know, there are 11 HBCUs in North Carolina.
I know.
There are 11 HBCUs right in North Carolina alone, more than any other.
Didn't we lose Nova Scotia? We lost one of those colleges, Nova Scotia, and we lost Kittrell Junior College.
You know, you right up on it. See, Kittrell, we lost Bobby Kittrell, but the rest of them are still here.
I think North Carolina has the most historical African American college.
That's right.
Yes.
And so that's saying something, and that affects the people, the people's thinking, and the progression of a people. Education, you know, education is what the Prophet Muhammad said about education is an obligation on every Muslim and Muslim up. So
it's an obligation on every Muslim woman and man.
That's right. That's right. So, it's really a human thing for growth and development to get the knowledge and seek the knowledge and then put the knowledge in action. So we had a good ground, and we had people who were dedicated in the community. You remember they talk about Tulsa? But we had Wilmington, North Carolina, and they did the same thing they did in Tulsa, in Wilmington, North Carolina, because the business of people, and these were Democrats at the time, they killed people, man, and sent them around in the swamps because they had the
that's
business.
And don't forget, brother, North Carolina, we had the Farmers and Mechanics Bank. We had one of the largest insurance companies. North Carolina, is that company still existing? Yes, sir.
North Carolina Mutual was the largest insurance company in the world.
That's right.
The Spaldings. Yes.
Is it still in existence?
All of them knew my grandfather. My grandfather, it's in the history book. It's a book like his. It's like my grandfather says he was trying to build this. You know, the Mills brothers used to come, and all these Indians used to come to town, and they didn't have no hotels to stay in. And so my grandmother, I remember the story. My grandmother said the Mills brothers were staying at my grandfather's house, and my grandmother said, "Calvin, you know, there's a lot of people staying at our house coming in and out of there. You know what?" He said, "We can't have this. You got to build a hotel." So he built a hotel downtown. He was a hotel dress for everything.
Wow.
He built the hotel in the complex. That was all. That was that right in the downtown area. The African, he built the African American. He designed the building. I got pictures of all that stuff, man.
This is very important. This was when they had that foot on our neck. And tell us also about, I think you had a relative of yours that owned a hospital. You say you never had gone to any white doctor.
My mother was born in the hospital. My father was born in that hospital. That's before they got married. I was born in that hospital. My tonsils was moved in that hospital. I mean, that was Macaulay Hospital.
Wow.
Man, it's interesting. So when I came out of the military, when I came into the military and all these Caucasians, so I come from ANT and before that, all African-American situation. That's the first time I had been introduced to Caucasians, in that way, I didn't know other way, but we competed. We competed, we competed.
You were a B-52 pilot in the United States Air Force, I believe. Now, what rank do you ended up when you left the United States military?
Well, I was a captain. I was a captain. I was a B-52 aircraft commander. I had over 120 combat missions over North Vietnam. I'm going to tell you something, brother. That's just a little too much. Those guys were very unfriendly. They were shooting everything at us. So I said, look, I got to get out of here. If God gets me out of here. And I went to fight a friend of this guy. So I that was a little bit cool.
You ended up flying also out of my hometown of Lynchburg, Virginia. I guess perhaps you needed some B-52 bombers that you passed Lynchburg. But you flew for Piedmont Airlines. And I remember flying Black Sabine fly on Piedmont Airlines. Tell us what that was like for you. As being a pilot,
I was the second pilot hired by Piedmont. The first one was Juan Wheeler. Mr. Wheeler was the owner of the bank, president of Mechanical Farmers Bank. And I knew them from growing up from childhood. But Mr. Wheeler sent his son through all that private pilot stuff, but I went to the military. And it just so happened that he was there. When I went in the military, Juan was the only pilot on with them. And then when I came back, that's 5 years later, I became the second pilot to be hired by Piedmont Airlines.
So you flew throughout the South and to Chicago and different. Did you ever come across a man by the name of Jim Tillman? I see him on TV.
I knew Jim Tillman. He's the weatherman. He's the weatherman, Chicago weatherman. Yeah, Jim. He flew for United. See, here's an interesting thing. The first African-American pilot hired in the United States, period, worked for United Airlines. When he was hired for United Airlines?
When?
1962.
Wow.
That's the first pilot. Now, look, I knew.
That's only 52 years ago.
There's a guy I knew. He was a Tuskegee Airman. Excuse me, but I always thought Tuskegee Airmen was just the pilots, okay? And I learned subsequently that anybody who had anything to do with operations, mechanics and everything, were Tuskegee Airmen. But I just learned that. I didn't know that. But I knew some pilots. In World War II, one guy, he was so proud of us because we worked with airlines and stuff, and he could never do that. He in 1947, when he got out of the military after World War II, he couldn't get a job as a pilot. You know what he did? And I said, this is a big man. He shined shoes, man. This was a man who had combat missions in Italy and the P-51s. He was a pilot and everything. He couldn't get a job. He couldn't get a job at the airlines. That was an impossibility. Not until 1962. So can you imagine the humility of this man, a pilot, a captain, and he got a shine shoe. He had shine shoes for a living. Isn't that amazing?
I was listening to a tape by Imam Muhammad. I was watching last night, The Super Ego. And I invite all of you all who haven't watched it to watch it. Imam Muhammad says, it's not enough to get kicked in your behind. but it's enough to keep your humanity. And here's a man repeat that he was a pilot for the United States.
Uh-huh.
He flew combat missions, couldn't get a job as an airline pilot, and came back to feed his family in giant shoes. That's dignity. There's not somebody complaining, talking about the Koreans took this from us, that one took this something from us, this one got something from us. These people are willing to do whatever it takes to feed their family and keep their human dignity. That's when God rewards us. Yes.
And I remember leaving Shaw University when we were marching in the streets in the civil rights movements, marching in the streets, sitting in on the counters and stuff. And I couldn't go to a Burger King. I couldn't eat a Burger King. Seen in my lifetime, now I own the Burger King.
It is really amazing. It also tells us something about our people, and it tells us something about the elasticity of America. Let me ask you this. 50 years ago, did you believe an African American would be the president of the United States, especially one with a Muslim name?
No.
Did you ever believe that?
No, that was off the radar, as they say. That's off the radar.
Can you see the possibilities of, and you all can join the conversation at 805-727-701, because I don't want to hog this discussion, because this is a very powerful discussion with our brother. I just call him as Brother Majid. Abdul Majid, but give us your whole name. I knew him as also an imam. I knew him as a pilot. But I want him to give us a proper name, and I want you to join the conversation at 805-727-7013. If you're already on the air and you're listening via phone, just press 1 on your phone. Isn't that something? We have an airline pilot. He didn't graduate from the state prison. He didn't graduate from reform school. His parents, his great parents, were outstanding African Americans there in North Carolina, college graduates, and he evolved through the Nation of Islam. When I say his family, I know he's probably just like I was, a good Baptist,
but
a good Pentecostal. But we were decent, upright people. And we saw that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was really talking about the same thing that our ancestors talked about. The ISIS falls and set itself. The people that built Canada, the Shaw University was supported by us. So we already believed in do for self. So when you heard the message of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, when you were right now, Air Force Base, it already resonated with you.
That's right.
It's
on my heart. That's right. That's exactly right. And that one aunt, my great-great-great aunt, remember Anna Julia Cooper, who was a second grad from Oberlin? But she got her doctorate back in the 20s at the Sorbonne in France.
You tell me we ain't a stupid people.
In French.
Brother Majid, you can't make no arguments that we are not a super people. I'm telling you. And I don't mean it in the sense of some racial superiority. We have a super humanity.
Anna Cooper, she you heard of the Dunbar School in Washington?
Yes, I heard of the great Dunbar.
Well, it was
seventh,
it was called 7th Street School. She was the principal of that school. And she had a fallout with Booker T. Washington. See, she had a fallout with Booker T. Washington, and Booker T. Washington got a fire. But she was with
Booker D was pretty powerful. Well, I want to tell you, I have to compensate for that, because Booker T. Washington's great-grandson is a frequent guest on this program, Brother Imam Musa Abouri. So I have to tell him about that. We got to give his grandfather a demotion for that one. Because I know about the Anna Cooper.
She was a great suffragette. She was at the Niagara Conference with DuBois in the Niagara Conference. But she was outstanding. They got a stamp for her about 2 years ago. They made a stamp for her, and she's a Haywood. Her name was Anna Julia Haywood, but she married a Cooper. But that was my aunt. That was my Aunt Annie. We used to go up and visit her in Washington. She died at 102.
Wow.
She was 102. So we all call Aunt Annie. So I was a young boy. We used to travel to Washington to go see Aunt Annie. But she had her own private school also there after Dunbar. She came back to Dunbar again, and then she had her own private school there also. So I have some interesting people, man. We have some interesting people in our family that I guess we got to hold the role. It put a lot of pressure on you. Just to much is expected, we got to expect great things from our children. We got to expect great things from our young people, and we got to put the pressure on them. Like they had to squeeze Prophet Muhammad, the angel had to squeeze Prophet Muhammad, put pressure on him. He said, I can't read, but the pressure of life, the right pressure brings out the excellence of the human being, and that's what the explanations that Imam W. Muhammad have given us, and the work of the great Amalaj Muhammad, as we progress through this stages of growth and development. Alhamdulillah, brother, we are blessed people.
Yes, we are. To be distinguished and descendant of Anna Cooper and the great people that you're descendant of, and that you had the presence of mind to evolve with our people. I think this is a very great people. Now, I understand you ran for political. Well, first, before we go to your political career,
yeah,
I want to get back to your personal life. Do you have children, and are you a father? Tell us about that.
I have four children. I have a boy in New York, and his wife is there in New York. She's an entertainment lawyer. He's a business person. He deals with the NBA. He has some sunglasses that he's working with the NBA to be an exclusive distributor sunglasses in the NBA and NHL and all that kind of stuff. So they're working out of New York. I got one who's a sculptor. He's an outstanding sculptor, man. He's in Chicago. His name is Fahim Majid. He does metal sculptures. He's just blessed. He's just truly, truly blessed. And his wife live in Chicago. And I got the young one is in college now, and one in Atlanta who's about a year, two years behind him is in Atlanta, and one's just finishing college here. And the last one out is finishing college here in North Carolina. So,
Are your children, are they Muslims still in this association?
Three are still Muslim. They're practicing Islam. Three of them are practicing Islam. Not practicing Islam. So he's not practicing Islam, but he's just, he's...
He identifies with it. Okay, well, sometimes one act is sufficient for a whole lifetime. These are very,
yeah,
very difficult times. Let me ask you this, Brother Majid. Do you think this is a very difficult time to raise children? When you and I were coming up, we had the Civil Rights Movement. Even if you didn't join the Civil Rights Movement, the Nation of Islam, the Black Panthers, the student movement.
Yes, right.
You still could just be a decent citizen, go to school, teach school, do whatever you like, and you could be a good citizen. Today it seems to me that it takes a super ordinary person, particularly as an African-American male. It's very difficult in this time. What would you say to a young 15-year-old young person who's in a besieged, gang-ridden neighborhood? Tell us, what would you say to that young man? Because that young man may be listening to us now. There might be a young man right now listening to us just got out of jail. There may be a young woman who is homeless but has all the aspirations of Dr. Cooper and wonder how can she make it. What can you tell those three young persons?
It's easy for us to say because we've been practicing faith for a long time. And through the practice, we've gained much strength. When people, in the society today, with all they've been bombarded with, they have to kind of go back and they have to hear, listen to the good conscience, and also the good things that their parents taught them, to find strength in the difficult times, especially when so many young people are. Have prison records. It's hard to get jobs. It's hard to get jobs, period. And then with that, it's even harder. So they get discouraged. They bombarded with Satan's, attack. And so you just have to listen to the best self. and they have to listen to their upbringing and hear what the people said before them, the good things, and they know right from wrong. But it's being constantly bombarded with all of this these ideas, these negative ideas. You know, the song. See, this is another thing. See, a great disservice is being done, and I think they're doing it for the sake of money. I know they're doing it for the sake of money, and some of them not even doing it for the sake of money. But those who have powerful influence, those rap artists, and even W. Humphrey said they wrapped us up like a mummy, and put us in buried us. But these influences. And they're listening to it, and if they're not listening to it consciously, subconsciously, it's putting a very bad message. And the message delivers them to a destination that they have no other choice but to go there, based on the program. And so it's a bad program, and it's affecting a lot of kids. And really, it should be a crime. I'm just sorry. It should be a crime for what the music industry and the Satan, how he used the music industry to take us out of the game of life. You know, when I remember when rap first started, they didn't rap like this. They didn't do the misogyny and downing women and this and that. And that's what it's all about now. It's lewd. It's immorality. And our kids are – there's so many fronts they're getting hit from. We didn't get hit from all those fronts. But somehow, God is the greatest. If they can make it and get them, and just like those salmon's going upstream, it's a lot of resistance. But if you can get through that, man, you're great, because that resistance is something that's prepared you and give you an education for success in life. You got the muscle to do it, but it's the struggle that you will develop that muscle. And like I said again, most people say, I was just listening to a lady on Facebook. She says, I'm tired of people telling me I look good. I want to be married. Isn't that something? And I just
thought, isn't that something?
What is telling her that? It deep down, she wants the what God put in her. She wants, and she wants to get there, but she can't quite figure it out right now. But that was her rope feeling that says, I want to be married. I ain't happy. People tell me I'm looking good, but I want to be married. I'm tired of being single. So it comes to the point of your life, that's when I come, you're going to reach the point, like, I had to come to the Nation's Law, I got all of these things, I got all these cars, I got all these things, I got all this money, I got all this prestige. But then I'm not happy. I got to do something for myself. I got to join something that's about something and have a purpose in life. And through this avenue and through the struggles and through these avenues of learning and understanding myself and being on the right path, I found myself in the process.
Yes, sir.
And
even though you drove up to the mess, even though you drove up into the masthead and a Porsche, you had a Volkswagen like Spirit that had been repressed. You had a Rolls Royce Spirit.
I wanted a life.
You wanted a life. You wanted a life bigger than
life.
Yourself.
That's right. Yes. The material is not life. No, my spirit was poor, and I wanted,
sir.
and that offered me something in the holding pen at the time, so I can get to what Imam W. Muhammad shared with us, the Quran. I love that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, you were also a classmate of the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson. I believe he was a student body president at A&T when you were there.
I know him very well, and even with Burger King, we went through some things with Burger King subsequently after that. But in college, he was a junior and I was a freshman. I knew him there then. Mm-hmm.
I played it. Look, you talking about, you know this, what's that? Get on. What's that program? A James Brown movie just came out, right?
Yes, sir.
James Brown movie. Well, I know Mayfield was in the band with me at A&T. Mayfield was in the band. And, we got Onion Head with LTD and Sam and Dave. They stayed on the block. But A&T had a lot of great they gigged on the weekends, all of them. They gigged on the weekends. And the drummer, we had six drummers in the A&T band. I was one of them. And Melvin was the drummer. But he's a James Brown drummer also. So after Mayfield got in, James Brown wrote him and said, I want you to be my drummer.
And he was a drummer for James Brown. And, you know, I looked at that program another day. I saw that show. I saw that that movie. But something was missing. Something was missing. I don't know what it was. Now, that man who did James Brown, he did an excellent job. Played James Brown, did an excellent job. That was excellent. But you know what I found out? They said a lot of Caucasian writers wrote that thing and wrote that. And that's what – I just found that out subsequently. And I said, that's what's missing. They didn't know how to put the thing together.
Most of these Caucasian writers, they don't know anything really about our people. And frankly, they don't give a damn about our people. They just want to put some commercials, so they don't have our spirit. So they can't understand Maceo. They see Maceo as a joke. They see us as a joke.
And I was telling my son before I learned that, that was four days later, I learned that. But I was telling my son, but if something is not flowing, if something is not right, it's about the flow. You know, Ray Charles, that was a great story, how they put it together. But that one, they missed it. They missed it completely.
I agree with you. Ray Charles was a very powerful story. But, you know, maybe it was that James Brown was so powerful, his spirit was so powerful, that these people didn't want to bring a man, a transcendent figure. James Brown, if you think about it, there's no generation since he's been out who hasn't been affected by him. Rappers still sample James Brown's music. James Brown has a beat. And we also have to be very honest and say James Brown was heavily influenced by Islam.
Oh, yes. Heavily influenced
by the Abdullah Muhammad.
We were calling people black men. That was us. He got that from us. That's black men. That comes
that's
from us.
Right. That's exactly right. Imam Muhammad was talking about that. Man. Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And so, but let me tell you about an experience I had with James.
What was your impression? Someone just asked me in the studio, what was your impression of the portrayal of Maceo?
I didn't like that. I don't know. I'm gonna ask Maceo when I see him. He's from Kinston, North Carolina. I'm gonna ask Maceo when I see him, and he comes down every couple of years or so. But I'm gonna ask him when I see him. Maceo, did they do it right? Or maybe they said what you protested, but was it the way it was done? Was it the way it went down? That's what I'm gonna ask him. And so that's my question to Maceo when I see him.
Do you think that Maceo was portrayed as a clown, or what picture did you get of Maceo?
Look how Maceo's very intelligent guy now. Maceo was a music major, but he left his junior year. He left to go with Brown, and later on his Melvin went as a drummer. James Brown about a year or so later. And I used to see him all the time when they come to town, you know. So I'm going to ask him how he was portrayed, because you remember how they portrayed Ahmad Muhammad in those movies.
Right.
They didn't portray Ahmad Muhammad with no dignity. I didn't like the way they portrayed Ahmad Muhammad. Ahmad Muhammad was the thinking. He was the brain behind this, by the grace of Allah.
That's right.
They're not Malcolm. And so they have never given him his true position of what he did. He should be bound, have a gold statue down for what he did, and then charge the social service community nothing. He took people and all over this country. They should give the social service, the Department of Human Services and stuff, should give him a golden statue down in D.C. for what he did
to
help this country and deal with the problems that they had made, to clean up the problems they had made.
That's exactly right. They always talk about the Abdullah Muhammad got the broken people. But, you know, you and I were broken. We didn't come in the Nation of Islam as broken people. You know, you came from being an airline pilot, and there were thousands upon thousands of people that came in the Nation of Islam.
That's right.
Come out of good homes.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Thousands, yeah.
If Abdullah Muhammad hadn't taken those people in and worked with them, whatever, they would have been a scourge. They would have tore this country down, man.
That's exactly right. They would have tore this country down. That's right. We had students of the student movement that if Abdullah Muhammad had not channeled that energy, That's right. These were serious thinkers. They were revolutionaries, and Abdullah Muhammad did America a great service. I want you to continue commenting on that contribution that Abdullah Muhammad made to the civil rights movement.
That's exactly right. But getting back to Maceo and Melvin, and I was at the airport one day, and a friend of mine, who's the third pilot, he was a class behind, but I was actually driving the airliner. He was still in going through training, and he said, "Well, we were up in the flight room, and I think I was in between flights or something like that." So he said, "You know, James is coming in town, and you know, James didn't give me the job. I asked James to let me fly his plane, and he wouldn't let me fly it. And so I was mad, man. I'm anxious. I got my bow tie on and everything. So I said, "So when is he coming in? What time is he coming in?" So I went out on the ramp when he came in with his little jet and everything. And Bobby Brown got off. Bobby Bird got off the plane, and some old couple Caucasians got off the plane, and the pilots were there. And so James came off. I said, James, look, man. I said, look, my man, my brother told me that you wouldn't hire him as a pilot. And, I mean, I was all up in his face. I was all in James' face. By that time, the Caucasians came up to me, and they were like, and I said, and he overheard me talking to James about flying the plane, you know. And so he came to me and said, "Man, this is a sophisticated piece of machine." I said, "Man, I ain't talking to you. You know, be bold." I said, "Man, I'm not talking to you."
I heard repeat that you told him. I ain't talking to you now.
I'm not talking to you. You stay out of the car. By the time James called, we were getting ready to go at it, and James kind of pulled me up to go, "Hold on, brother, brother. That's all right. Come on." He said, "Hey, brother, James, I got it. Come on over here, brother. Let's talk. He said, "So I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to work on that. I'm going to do something." But I know, you know, subsequently I found out, man, that they were mafia guys, man. The mafia had all this stuff. The mafia had, they had all
that. Wow.
You know, this is no reflection, but you know who ran the boxing industry until Muhammad Ali came in? And the mafia and a lot of those guys were happened to be Jewish and stuff like that, but they ran those industries. And Herbert was one.
That's exactly right.
He broke Muhammad Ali out of it and got the money. Muhammad Ali was the first one to get the break out of it.
Right.
They had the FOI behind and everything. And so
that's
that was
exactly right.
I didn't realize it yet, but that's how bold we were. I go up and I chastised James. I said, because I knew Mason was with him and I knew Mel was with him. And here's another thing. When I grew up also, my neighbor was a big promoter, African-American promoter. See, when Nat King Cole came to town, he stayed in his house. when Ray Charles came, he told me, but I was talking to my friend. We grew up together. We used to sell the tickets at Rock and Roll shows. And after the Rock and Roll shows, yeah, we go to the backstage and talk to all the Jackie Wilson and all that kind of stuff. We done our job and stuff. But Ray Charles, he said one time his daughter, and it was hit him, and Ray was in the back seat, and Ray say, he said, "This is a Cadillac," and told him the year that the Cadillac was. This was this story. He told him the year that the Cadillac was, and it was a Cadillac. He said, "Damn, Ray, how you figure that out?" But and Frankie Lyman, in the drugstore that my grandfather built and leased out in the hotel up top downtown, I used to sit down and drink milkshakes with Frankie Lyman.
Wow.
We had a real
community. We had neighborhoods. We had hotels.
That's right. Office buildings. And so Frankie Lyman was 13 going on 45. Frankie Lyman was 13. I was 13. He was 13 going on 45. But it was an interesting community, brother. Al Hibbler, Groove Brown, all of them. I can say all them entertainers. I remember one night, you know, Tissotron saved a whole lot of people's lives, those promoters' lives, because they used to carry guns, you know. They didn't, and they I remember one time they pulled them guns, man, who was it? Bobby Roode Bland wouldn't come to the show. He wouldn't come out the bus until they paid him his money. But, man, Tissotron saved a whole lot of promoters' lives, because they would shoot each other. I mean, you know, about money and stuff like that. But I was all in selling tickets in those shows and going back with the entertainers, Major Lance, all them boys. I had a wonderful childhood, man. Very interesting childhood, you know.
Someone in the studio were talking about your rich life. And I was telling him that you, I suppose that's where your son, I just thought about that, your son got the artistic leaning. Do you still play the drums?
Do I still what?
Do you still play the drums? We were talking about your versatile life, how you had been, had become,
oh,
had you, yes,
you
a,
know,
a musician,
I,
a businessman.
Yeah. You know, and another friend of mine, Matt around the corner of me, he played, they played, he played drums for the Four Tops. His name was Clarence. He passed last year. And what it was is I played the violin when I was in the fourth grade. I was very good, man. And so I changed, and I wanted to play the drums because I had another family cousin of mine. He was an entertainer. He was at a young age, and he played drums. So I wanted a trap set. And so I said, Mom, if I make straight A's for the next 2 years, at the end of the two-year period, you will buy me a trap set. She said, yes, you make straight A's. Well, I made straight A's. And at the end of that time, she wouldn't let me get a trap set. And I know why she didn't want to do it, because she didn't want me to get in that industry. She figured I grew up too fast, like my cousins did, and you know, and get into a lot of other things. But and then I just quit. I stopped. And the next time,
well, your mother was a very wise woman. I've seen a lot about.
I see it now. She didn't want me to grow up. She didn't want me to get in that. She didn't want me to be in that. And she couldn't tell me, but she just. But it was really let down. So I stopped playing anything. I didn't play anything until I got into college my freshman year, and that's when I, just for the challenge of it, I went back and played in the band. I picked up a drum again, and I played in the band. And that, for that 1 year after that, then I left it again. But I guess that's a challenge. That's why I met Melvin and Maceo and all those guys, and you know, in the music industry. In that,
let me ask you this. This next week is our week that we focus on culture. I wonder, do you think that culture is a very, maybe a missing link in our community? It seems to me that we have, as a Muslim leadership body, haven't put enough emphasis on culture. Imam Muhammad certainly did. But it seems to me our leaders don't see the need for the big band, don't see the need for ballroom dancing, don't see the need for development of instruments, of having our own bands, making our own movies, writing our own novels. You know, because I think that there needs to be novels written about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I think there are novels which should be written about people like you. I really think until we as a people develop a dynamic, burgeoning culture, we're never going to go anywhere. We can have all the prayer meetings we want to. But I want you to spend a few minutes talking about the importance of culture and life of a people.
Yeah, well, you know that's very important. You know, we have it. We have it right now. Look at what we have. We have it wrong. The hip hop is a culture. All that stuff is a culture. But look what they're transferring through that medium. Satan, like he takes a complete control of it. You know, one thing wrong with keep on pushing, get on up, you know, a little higher. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But like I said, what are they saying now? Beat this B and beat that and call this the mother of downgrading marriage. Everything. They're using the culture in a negative way. They're using the medium. We got the medium, but it's Satan has defiled it. And now, we got culture bad. We got culture bad. We still got some culture, but we got culture. Most of our culture is bad and making other people. Like many members of W. Hump said, it's destroying Satan as an equal opportunity employee. And he used that to destroy other people. All over the world, they're rapping these ugly songs now. They're doing these ugly dances now. Not the decent cultural dances and not the decent music. Yeah, they're doing indecent things. So we got it, but we got it wrong. And the money seems to be the object by any means necessary. Isn't that something?
Yes.
That's terrible.
Yes.
That's terrible. And, you know, and it said, Malcolm had it wrong. We can't do things by any means necessary. We got to do it by the right way. We got to do it the right way. We can't do it by any means necessary. He was just wrong. That's just wrong. And, you know, Imam W. Hummel pointed out a lot of things that you know, to correct the situation and how we should look at things so we can have peace, you know, and peace and prosperity.
Now, let me ask you this. You have You ran for office recently. Do you have any plans to run for office again? And if you are going to run for office, tell us how we can support you.
Well, I ran for state senate, and I thought it was a shoo-in. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I had three other persons, males, who ran, and they took votes from me, and that's how another person's sister got in, who I had beat before on city council. And so I'm looking to level the playing field, and I have a one-on-one coming up in about a year and a half or so, with a one-on-one, and I'm trying to work that situation where I can have that type of a competition with her, and I think I'll be all right. Politically speaking.
Also, a member, I believe you perhaps even as a chairman of the American Coalition for Good Government.
What is the American Coalition for Good Government? Tell us
what that organization does and its influence, and what are your plans for this organization?
Well, you know, now we were formed back in 1997. We got together, and Judge David Shaheed, Bilal Beasley, brother from Selma, he came on a little later on. He just talked to my brother tonight. He was on
Abdul Salam.
Abdul Salam, and brother Jimmy Salam out of East Orange. A lot of us were elected officials, so I talked with Imam W. Muhammad, and I wanted to, you know, get us together and get our political people together, and also our people in government service together, and so we can affect do dawah as far as what Islam was, and let people know about what Islam was as far as and educate people, and also affect change in the community. Effect change in the community from the local to the national level. And mm-hmm. So Imam thought that was a great idea. And matter of fact, he was our honorable chair. He was our honorable chair. And when we first started, Earl Muhammad helped facilitate all that also at that time. And we got together in that historic meeting here in Charlotte. And matter of fact, the blueprint for the organization and the blueprint for how we should utilize politics in America, Imam W. Muhammad laid it out, and it's still good today, and it's going to be good after that. And he explained that situation. Everybody should go. That's a very significant piece of lecture material that those people who aspire to be in politics and aspire to make changes in America should listen to that very carefully. And so we got off in 1997. And we developed, we grew, and right now I am not associated. I'm not the chairman of the American Coalition for Good Government. It's Brother Marvin Muhammad doing a wonderful job out of Houston, Texas. He is the chair, and many others are doing a wonderful job and continue that process on. But we needed that aspect, and Imam W. Muhammad wanted that aspect of us to have a political arm, educational arm for our community and for community, and go even beyond our community on educating people about politics and good politics for that. I said it should be some kind of coalition. He agreed, and he said, but it should be good government. And so I said, that's how I got.
We talked off the line about, in your district, 4,000 people being registered to vote, and I don't know how many of them voted. But that's a sad thing.
But there's one precinct. 4,000 people in one of the precincts, which is a precinct that endorsed me, but only 400 people came out. And this is off the election also. So I think that's going
to
change.
But, I mean, we are people. It seems to me for all the bullet clubs that went upside our head, the men of people that would kill our sister, Danny Gohamer, kidney was nearly dislocated. It would just seem to me that should be enough inspiration. I have never failed to vote. My soul won't allow me. I don't care what election it is. If it's a cat catcher, I'm going to vote. Because I remember a time, you may not have ever old enough to remember. I remember the poll taxes. He had to pay poll tax.
Oh, my gosh.
Poll tax, right, yeah. How many beans, how many jelly beans in this jar? Yes. See,
read
so what I'm saying is.
Read this statement.
That's right. There are a lot of our people couldn't vote. They were going to tell them they couldn't vote. Now, you know, Sheriff Jim Clark slapped C.T. Vivian down for saying he wanted to vote, register
that's
to vote.
Right.
So
that's
I don't
right.
think I can sit down and not vote. That's what I'm saying. To me, it just,
well,
it just baffles my mind. And you know what I hate to say? There are Muslims. I've heard Muslims say, why should I vote?
Well, they don't, isn't there something? And you know, hold it. I'm going to clarify something. Out of 4,000 registered voters, there's more people in there. Out of 4,000 registered voters for two precincts, only 400 voted.
Well, now let me ask you, how many of those people in that district are not even registered? That's let's get to the bigger.
Oh, that's beyond that. In the district, in my district, the city council district. Well, we're talking about state senate, 200 some thousand people. In the city council district, there were 125 some thousand people.
Only 4,000 out of 100,000 eligible voters vote. That's sad. Isn't that sad? That is a crime.
9%, 9%, 9% turnout.
9%.
Of 200,000 people.
So we really, we are all people.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Isn't that something? What a sad state. What can we do as Muslims to even rally our own population? I know I even said, I don't know how many people among Muslims that vote. You know, I heard a lot of us talking, voting doesn't mean anything. You know, I heard some of us say the president ain't doing a good job. Would you comment on our great president, President Barack Hussein Obama? What do you think of him and his great work? Or maybe he ain't doing great work. Let me hear what your comments are.
Well, you know what former President Clinton said about him? He said, we tried everything to win this race, but he said, but history was on his side. Now, what is he saying?
Yes, sir.
He's saying, God is on his side. That's what he said. He can't say God is on his side, but history is on his side. That's right. God was on his side because we did everything we could to stop it. We couldn't stop it. And so, you know, Almighty God's Allah's hand was on that. I'm some of the things that he did that I wouldn't do, and I think some of the things he did that and the results from those things he did, he suffered some, but overall, you got to look at the big picture, you know, don't eat that part that's bad, that's not consistent with your social mores or whatever. But overall, he's done a tremendous job, man. But it's just these people in the RP elections, they don't vote, and that's the Republicans got back. Same thing happened in North Carolina. We got a Republican Senate and House, and they just doing some damage. Now, hopefully, in this coming election, we don't give the Senate back to them. Good God Almighty, they're gonna run ramrod over the president. And I don't think he's got to veto everything, you know. But these people are. I don't know what we're gonna do to get these people to understand the importance of that vote. And you know, a lot of times they look at politicians when the politicians do something bad. You know, they're not. A lot of politicians are not good examples. And they got the money in there. Look what's going on in Detroit. Look what we went going down in these cities, in D.C. and all around the country. Even here in Charlotte, we had problems with elected officials that, you know, violating federal laws and state laws and local laws as far as taking money is concerned. And when people see that, that kind of turns the people off, too, also. And so it's the build up the trust again. You know, I always told MLW Harmon, he says, I was a politician. I said, no, buddy, man. I said, I'm a statesman. I don't want to be a politician. We got to bring some dignity back in time. But until that time, I'll be a statesman.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. 100% right. Let me ask you, what do you see as the future for African Americans? You got 3 minutes. I want you to tease out where you see the future of African American politically, first economically, and then politically. In light of the United Citizens, wherein anybody can put $50 million into a political campaign, corporations can campaign as though they're an individual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think these are just the realities, and we can get mad if we want about it. But it seems to me that we got to muster up and measure up.
I think the future is bright, but our only limitations are us. We make our limitations. The future is bright. We make our limitations. You know what you put your mind to do, you can do it. But it's got to be on your mind, and then you got to understand that Rome is not built in a day. You know, it takes time. It takes methodology. But you got to work in a coordinated way towards your goals. But you got to have it in your mind. You know, business, be it business, be it politics, industry, whatever profession, whatever avenue. You know, if you have it in your mind and you prepare yourself, the future is bright. Because as Imam said, so many people are being distracted now about other things, and this is the time to get ahead when they're distracted. You know, and so I think the future is bright. But you got to have something on your mind. You got to have something on your mind, and then you got to have the fortitude to work toward it and prepare yourself to achieve that goal. So I think we can think of things that our forefathers, a lot of people, couldn't even imagine we could be doing now.
We got
some bright young people in this community. We have some excellent, some sharp people in this community, and they're gonna get ahead. And whether it be in business or economics, they're gonna get ahead. We got the leaders in the United States right in this community. And so you get some on your mind and work toward it, there's nothing you can't achieve. I think the future's bright.
I know it's bright because you're an indication of it. And you're so bright, you told me you wouldn't be able to talk for 45, maybe 15 minutes, and you're gone.
You're gone
about an hour. I want you to close us out. You got a one-minute statement to close us out with.
Well, Imam Alpha, I'm so honored to be on your show. The substance of, by the grace of God, what we talked about, I hope some people can understand, the roads that have to be traversed, to understand the sacrifices that have been made to people in the past, and that we can carry those good works on to the future and assume more leadership roles in the community, in the United States, and in the world. And, I thank you for the opportunity to be on your program. And, again, like I said, I thought 15 minutes, and this time has gone by. And I think it's been very rewarding for me. I hope it's been rewarding for others, and I appreciate the opportunity.
And we appreciate you. We want the people to know that we're playing in high cotton, y'all. Don't think we're playing in low cotton. We're in high cotton. Almighty God has blessed us to be a very evolved people that was raised up for all people. We were raised up for all people for the good. So we thank our noble and honorable listeners. And you all don't forget something now. Everybody didn't participate, but everybody can participate by sending donations to Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. Last week we thought we were going to be off the air. By the grace of God, you sent donations. We want to buy time for Shelby on major AM radio stations. So we need your donation to be sent to Imam Alfred Muhammad at 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. And you can write me, imamalfred@gmail.com. Peace be on our honorable and noble listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. Tomorrow, we will have a program with Ron Howell, professor of journalism at Brooklyn College. We will be discussing fatherhood. So tune in tomorrow at 6 o'clock on Religion Means Alive. Peace upon you.